Dubai the next day, and he grinned broadly. Now, that's an interview I'd like to see. He's a much more interesting subject. More controversial, perhaps, Blaze said with a gleam in her own eye, but surely not as interesting or charming. She thanked him for the interview then, wished him luck in his endeavors, and they both walked away feeling they had made a friend, which happened to her often. Blaze was very good at what she did, and all her subjects, the men anyway, fell just a little bit in love with her. She came to life on camera as she did nowhere else, and she went back to the hotel, pleased with the interview, and knowing Charlie would be delighted. The Prime Minister had been an excellent subject. She had just enough time at the hotel to change her clothes again, put on something more comfortable, relax for a few hours, take a walk down New Bond Street in the crisp October air, order a quick meal when she got back to the hotel, and leave for the airport again for the flight to Dubai. It was almost the same length as the flight the night before from New York to London, about 45 minutes shorter, and she was planning to sleep so she'd be fresh when she arrived. She couldn't afford to be slow or sluggish or dull-witted for the Saudi prince. He was known to be sly and adept at avoiding key questions. She knew she'd have to be at her best for him, and she went to sleep the moment she got on the plane. And as she requested, they woke her up right before they landed. There was VIP escort service for her again, a Rolls-Royce Phantom limousine with a liveried driver, and she was taken to the Burj Al Arab Hotel. She only stayed at the best hotels when she traveled, particularly in foreign cities, which was in her contract. And they had to provide her limousines everywhere. She had been doing this for 25 years, and she had earned it. She took it for granted now, as part of the landscape for her. She had been to Dubai before, and she was impressed to see that they had put up even more modern structures since the last time she'd been there. And the hotel where she was staying looked palatial. The suite they gave her was one of the largest and most opulent she'd ever seen, and she had her own butler. There was a helipad for arriving guests. Her interview was scheduled for 9 o'clock that night, and she took the opportunity to take a drive around the city with her driver in the Rolls, while he pointed out the sights to her, and it was very impressive, although it was a place she wouldn't have chosen to come to on her own. But in the context she was seeing it, as a location for an interview, she found it fascinating. And when she got back to her hotel, she had new questions in mind to ask him. She knew that her subject normally lived in Riyadh, but due to the restrictions on women in his city, he had agreed to meet her in Dubai, when he had to go there on business. It was the most liberal of the Arab cities. She wore a long-sleeved, high-necked, somber but chic black dress as she waited for him to come to her suite in the living room, where the cameras had been set up. And she looked respectful and subdued, as was fitting. He was actually younger than she was, and she knew he had a somewhat racy reputation when he traveled, with a keen eye for young women. But she had a feeling that he would be more circumspect here, and with her. Blaze wasn't disappointed when she met Mohammed bin Sabur. He came to her suite in an exquisitely cut English suit, made by his tailor in London, and impeccably shined John Lobb shoes from Paris. He was dark, and had jet-black hair and a mustache, and he was one of the handsomest men she had ever seen. He was 35 years old and looked younger, and if she had been less serious about her work, she would have been tempted to flirt with him. Instead, they sparred for 2 hours in the interview. He was clever and amusing and had a great sense of humor. He had been schooled in England. For the first hour, he dodged most of her questions, but she had anticipated that and had saved the important ones for later, hoping to wear him down and surprise him. And she even dared to ask him about his brother, the alleged terrorist, and he laughed out loud when she asked the question. "What an interesting reputation my brother has," he said easily, without embarrassment. "The only one he terrorizes is me. He beat me up regularly when we were boys, quite mercilessly, and now he charms away all my women. He's a devilishly handsome man." He had slipped right through her question with ease. "So are you," Blaze said with the smile that she had been famous for since her youth in television. She was an even match for him. "Thank you, Miss McCarthy." She asked him several more pointed questions then, about oil in the Middle East and his business in the United States. He answered cautiously, but seemed to be sincere to a point. He was no fool, and he told her nothing he didn't want said on TV. He was just guarded enough, and just open enough, to make the interview fascinating to their viewers. And he was an incredibly seductive man, with an air of mystery about him. And from his playful answer, she surmised that his brother probably was exactly what was said about him. A terrorist of some kind, but she knew enough not to press the point. And she drew the interview to an elegant close. He bowed when it was over and thanked her, and then surprised her totally by pulling a small box out of his pocket and handing her a gift. She was stunned. No interview subject had ever done that before, although a few had sent presents to her afterward. But it was rare, except when they established genuine friendships. This, she knew, was just part of his charm. She opened it while he watched her, and found a gold bangle bracelet from Cartier with small diamond studs on it. It was an extremely generous gift from a very handsome man, and she was touched and flattered. "Thank you for a most enjoyable evening," he said to her. "I was wondering if you would be kind enough to join me for dinner." She hadn't expected that either. But Blaise had always been adventuresome, and she accepted without hesitation, and he was pleased. It was nearly midnight, but they were both exhilarated by the interview and wide awake. He took her to one of the finest restaurants in Dubai, Pierre Gagné's Riffley, in his Ferrari, and she felt totally at ease with him. Whatever his reputation with women, he was also very much a gentleman, and extremely sophisticated and civilized. He spent considerable time in Paris and London every month, with frequent trips to New York on business. She had fun with him. He seemed very taken with her, and she was intrigued by him. She had a strong sense that whatever she was seeing was what he wanted to show her, and who he really was remained well hidden. But what she did see was entirely likable. She wore his bracelet on her wrist all evening, and when she thanked him sincerely for both the gift and the evening, he thanked her for the interview again. She promised to send it to him on a DVD after it ran, and she hoped he'd be pleased. "May I call you when I'm next in New York?" he asked politely, and she smiled at him. "I'd like that very much," she said warmly, but she was sure he never would. She wasn't nearly racy enough for him, and it was unlikely that they'd become friends. But he had made her brief stay in Dubai a lot more fun, and she had a sense of adventure as she went back to her suite and looked at the bracelet again. She wrote him a note of heartfelt thanks to send the next morning before she left. He had been generous and cooperative and kind, as well as interesting as a subject. Her trip to Dubai to interview him had been well worth it and a total success, which wasn't always the case. She sent what they had to Charlie by computer, and he called her 2 hours later. "My God, Blaise, what did you do to the guy? You had him eating out of the palm of your hand." It was even better than he had hoped. Bin Sabur had looked completely smitten with Blaise. "Not exactly, and I'm not sure how honest he was with me. Like about his brother and on a number of other subjects, but he gave a great interview." "You got a great interview out of him. He didn't just sit there and spill his guts. You pulled it out of him like silk scarves out of a magician's hat. Lady, you are good." "Thank you," she said, smiling at the compliment. And even she had to admit it had gone well. She was anxious to see it for herself. "He gave me a diamond bracelet, too, from Cartier," she said with a giggle. "Did you sleep with him?" Charlie sounded shocked and worried. He didn't want her getting arrested for something she shouldn't do, but Blaise was too smart for that. "Of course not. It was a gift to thank me for the interview when it was over. He's actually a nice guy and very flirtatious. I let him take me to dinner, and after that I came back to my room." "Well, lock your door in case he shows up tonight. He looked like he wanted more on the feed I just saw. Guys don't give diamond bracelets for nothing. Guys in the States expect to get laid if they feed you dinner. At least here they hand out diamond bracelets. It's a better deal," she teased, but she was in good spirits. She had had fun with him, and he made her feel young and sexy again. Not having a man in her life for 4 years since Andrew, made her feel as though she were no longer a woman at times, and wonder if she ever would be again. "Just be careful until you leave. I don't want to have to get you out of jail if you break any laws, or look for you in Riyadh if he kidnaps you." "He won't. He admitted on camera tonight that he has 3 wives, and I'm older than he is by about 10 years.
"So? That didn't seem to be slowing him down, neither your age nor his wives. Besides, I think they're allowed 3 or 4 or 5.
"Don't worry, Charlie. I'll be home tomorrow." And this was good for him, too. It gives him great PR in the States. It was a win-win for us both, and I got a diamond bracelet on top of it. I'd say Dubai was a success.
"Just get your ass home. I'll feel better when you're back in New York."
She would, too. But she had enjoyed it, and was pleased it had gone well. As it often was in the life she led, interviewing fascinating subjects, it was more than just work. Sometimes it was magic, when it clicked. And it had, perfectly. She didn't hear from Mohammed bin Sabur again before she left. And she left her thank you note to him at the front desk to be delivered to his hotel, and she caught her flight back to New York. She felt a little bit like Cinderella after the ball. But instead of losing a slipper, she had a beautiful Cartier bracelet on her wrist and smiled every time she looked at it on the way home. She arrived in New York after the 14.5-hour flight, and she was back in her apartment 3 days after she had left. And both interviews looked fantastic when she saw them at work the next day. All of her producers were thrilled. It had gone particularly well. And Charlie made sure he checked out the bracelet when he saw her, and looked impressed.
"I'll bet you hear from him when he's in New York."
"I doubt it. Saudi men just give very generous gifts. Believe me, it doesn't mean a thing."
"I gave my wife a Cuisinart for our 10th anniversary," Charlie said, looking at her. "I didn't give her a bracelet like that."
She laughed. "That's why I'm not married anymore. I'd rather buy my own Cuisinart."
"You're not supposed to give household appliances, Charlie, after 10 years.
"She likes to cook," he said, looking miffed.
Blaze's first day back went well, but the time differences caught up with her that night. She went to bed at 8 o'clock and fell asleep in 5 minutes, and she was up at 5 the next morning, in time to see the sunrise, as she went over some research for interviews she was doing the following week. She was still thinking about going to California to cover the UCLA shooting, but the story seemed a little cold now. Pat Olden was still in a coma, and the doctors were no longer sure he'd come out of it, nor what his brain function would be if he did. It was tragic, but not necessarily newsworthy anymore. It was just sad. And as she sat in her kitchen reading the newspaper online at 7, she thought of visiting Salim at school. She had said she might, and she wanted to see her. She had no plans for the weekend, and she had the time. She looked at her watch and decided to do it. She was wide awake for the 3-hour drive to Springfield, Massachusetts. She could be there by 10 o'clock that morning, spend the day with Salima, and come home that night, which was what she usually did. There was a bed and breakfast near the school, where Blaze occasionally spent the night, but she preferred coming home to her own bed, and Salima didn't mind. They packed so much talking and hugging into a day's time that one day together seemed like enough to sustain both of them until Blaze came up again. She showered and dressed, got her car keys out of her desk, and called the garage to get her car ready. She only used it occasionally on weekends, and to go out to the Hamptons in the summer. Mostly she used it to visit Salima. She was smiling as she left the building. It was a beautiful, sunny day, and it had been warm when she got back to New York the day before, in typical Indian summer fashion. She loved this time of year in New York. She could hardly wait to see her, and it was always a pretty trip. She was feeling happy all the way to the garage, and as she started her car, she noticed the diamond bangle on her wrist again from the handsome Saudi man she had met in Dubai. She remembered what they had said about her then, that she led a perfect life. And for once, she had to agree. It really was. Chapter 3. The drive to Springfield was peaceful and beautiful, and by the time she took the turnoff 3 hours after she'd left New York, she felt happy and relaxed. Coming here was like going on vacation. It was another world, far from the stresses of New York. And when she came to visit her, she focused on Salima and nothing else. She saw the familiar landmarks on the road to Caldwell School, where Salima had spent the last 11 years, and she noticed a new house that had been built, and a church that had been restored. But essentially, nothing ever changed here. Most of the houses had been built a century before, and Blaze turned into the driveway with a sigh, anxious to see Salima. The students lived in cottages of 3 or 4, with a monitor living with them, since they were younger than Salima. The seniors were in 2-person cottages, and Salima had the only single small house on the grounds. Blaze had encouraged her to stay on after she graduated. She went to a community college nearby and was driven there every day. Salima came home for vacations, but Blaze felt it was a better life for her here, and Salima agreed. She didn't want to live in New York anymore. She wanted to stay in the quiet rural community that had been home to her for 11 years. Blaze was hoping she'd stay through college. She was a sophomore now, and the community college she attended was small. It wasn't challenging enough for her, but it was easy for her to manage. She had considered going to Dartmouth, but didn't want to live in the dorms. And going to a community college, she could stay at Caldwell. She liked having her own cottage here, and she was getting straight A's at school, which looked good if she ever transferred. She had gotten great grades, and was a diligent student at every age. Blaze drove straight to Salima's house, at the back of the property with beautiful trees all around it that were all turning scarlet. In summer, everything was a lush green, and Blaze had made a contribution that had allowed them to build an Olympic-sized swimming pool years before. Salima was an outstanding swimmer, and had been on the swimming team all through high school, although she couldn't compete anymore now that she was in college. But she was greatly loved at the school where she had been for so long. The younger students looked up to her, and the teachers were very kind to her. Abby, the monitor who lived with her, had been assigned to Salima for 5 years. Now they were best friends. Abby was 36 years old, but living in the protected environment of the womb-like school, she still acted and looked like a young girl. She wore pigtails most of the time, and she adored Salima. Blaze stopped her car in the little parking area nearby and walked down the well-tended path to the cottage. She could hear Salima's voice when she reached the door. She was singing, and the door was open as Blaze quietly walked in and saw Salima with her back to her in the living room. She and Abby were laughing at something while Salima tried to sing and finally collapsed, laughing, on the couch. She still hadn't heard anyone come in, and Blaze took 3 steps across the old beams of the floor in the front hall, and the moment she did, Salima's head turned. "Mom?" She knew her step anywhere, and always recognized it the moment Blaze walked in. "Mom," she said then, sure of it, and dashed across the living room to the hall, as Blaze smiled widely at her and held out her arms, knowing Salima would be in them in seconds. "I missed you too much. I had to come up today," Blaze said, as Salima threw herself into her mother's arms and nearly knocked her down and then spun her around. Abby watched them with a warm smile, and Blaze waved at her with a free hand. Salima looked as beautiful as ever, with features identical to her mother's, down to the cleft chin. The only difference was her dark brown hair, which she wore long. She turned her face toward her mother's and felt her face. She felt the tears Blaze always shed when she first saw her. "You're crying. Have I gotten uglier since last time?" Salima teased. "Totally. It makes me cry just looking at you," Blaze said with a smile. "Then I'm glad I don't have to see it," Salima said, joking with her, as they walked into the living room together, with Blaze's arm around her waist as Salima leaned close to her, and then flopped down on the couch. She knew exactly where things were. Everything in the cottage was familiar to her, and she had no trouble getting around. She was blind. She had been diagnosed with type 1 diabetes when she was 3 years old, which had been the heartbreak of Blaze's life. Her perfect baby had a severe case of juvenile diabetes, which could only be treated with insulin. And at first, Salima had cried at every shot and prick of her finger to check her insulin levels. They had eventually gotten her a pump, but she still had to be closely monitored. The pump kept her insulin levels at safe ranges for her, delivering the insulin over 24 hours through a catheter under the skin. And they clipped the pump itself to the waistband of her skirt or jeans. It had always worked well for her. Her eyes had been affected by the time she was 6, which they had been told was unusually early. She was too young to lose her sight, the doctors had assured Harry and Blaze. When she was 7, she could still see partially when her retinas detached, and by 8, she was fully blind. They had tried to keep her at home, but Harry lived in Los Angeles, and Blaze traveled all the time. She didn't trust the caretakers they had with her. She was never sure they were monitoring her properly. And Blaze had had to face the decision of giving up her career to take care of Salima full-time, or place her in a school for the blind, where they were better equipped to supervise her, monitor her medically, and keep her safe. Her diabetes had to be carefully managed. There was a full medical staff at her school, and they had decided to try it for 6 months. Salima had loved it from the moment she got there and felt at home with other children like her. She didn't feel different anymore. She had friends to play with all the time, and Blaze could relax, knowing that she was impeccably cared for. Blaze had continued working, and at the end of 6 months, it was clear that Caldwell was better for Salima, so much so that 11 years later, she had made the decision to stay on after graduation. She couldn't imagine living anywhere else anymore. Sometimes Blaze felt guilty knowing what a secluded life she led, and wondering if she needed more. But Salima was so happy here that Blaze didn't have the heart to bring her back to live in New York, with all the risks it presented for her. And Abby wouldn't have come with her. She had a mother who had been in poor health for years, and she wanted to stay nearby. So Salima had stayed on, and Abby went to the community college with her every day. Blaze had given her a car, and Salima was free to come and go. She had resident status now, and was no longer subject to all the rules that applied to the younger children there. And most of the teachers were her friends, but Abby was more like an older sister to her, or a mother. Thinking that always hurt Blaze a little, but Abby was so much better for her, and did everything Salima needed, at all times. Blaze knew only too well that she couldn't have done it, even if she didn't work. The responsibility of handling Salima's illness on her own had always made her anxious and frightened her. "So, what have you two been up to?" Blaze asked, as she sprawled on the couch next to her daughter. The two young women were like Siamese twins, always together, inseparable at all times. "I was trying to teach Abby to sing scales," Salima laughed at her. Abby was plain-looking, but had a sweet face, and was wearing jeans and a white fisherman sweater Blaze had brought her back from Ireland. And Salima was wearing the designer jeans and a pink sweater her mother had recently sent her. They both looked like kids, far younger than either of them were. Salima looked about 15, and Abby scarcely older. "She's hopeless," Salima added about her caretaker's singing skills. "She can't carry a tune to save her life. She can't even sing scales. I played some of the music for her that we've been studying at school, Renaissance music, and she hates it." Salima had sung in the school choir all through high school, and in a local church choir on Sunday. "That music is so depressing," Abby said with a wry smile, looking apologetic. "I think so, too," Blaze admitted. "Can't you study something more cheerful? Christmas carols, maybe? Then we could all sing along, or at least I could. I don't know where your musical gift came from, but it sure isn't from me," Blaze said with a grin. "I'm going to take Gregorian chants next semester," she said, enjoying torturing both of them. She had been gifted with an exquisite voice, and she leaped at every chance to sing. She had the best voice in the entire school, and the purest. She could hit the high notes every time.
"I'm moving out if you start chanting," Abby threatened, trying to sound menacing, but convinced no one.
"No, you won't. I'm the only one who knows how to braid your hair. You'll look a mess if you move out," Salima warned, and they all laughed.
Salima managed extremely well, especially on familiar turf, and she knew every inch of Caldwell and the grounds like the back of her hand. She was even able to get from one building to another sometimes without Abby, although Abby usually went with her. Salima particularly hated using a white cane and wouldn't use one. She just relied on Abby, and she had refused to have a seeing-eye dog ever since she'd gone blind. She hated dogs and didn't want one. Abby met all her needs to perfection. And in the cottage, Salima almost appeared sighted. She knew the placement of everything so well.
"Do you want to go out for brunch?" Blaise offered, but Salima usually didn't. She was happiest on the familiar school grounds, except for her classes at college, where she had no choice. It was why she had decided not to go to Dartmouth, despite her excellent grades. She thought it would be too hard to get around, and Abby couldn't go with her. And Salima couldn't manage without her. She was totally dependent on her, which was both good and bad. Blaise was well aware that if Abby ever left for any reason, Salima would be lost without her. "Abby promised to make her special waffles," Salima said, looking like a child again.
"It would be fun to eat at Peterson's," Blaise suggested. She always thought it would do her good to get out, but Salima seemed to have no need or desire to venture into the world. She was happy in her cottage.
"I'd rather eat here," Salima said bluntly. She lived in a cocoon that Blaise had provided for her, and Abby was happy in it with her. She was a local girl who had never ventured far from home. She had gone to New York for the first time with Salima, and looked terrified the whole time she was there when they came home for school vacations. It was Salima who had reassured her. Abby was used to it now, but it had taken several years. And while Salima was at home, they rarely left the apartment. They watched movies on Blaze's big movie screen, which Salima could listen to and follow, with tapes recorded by a movie describer to describe the action for the vision impaired. Salima loved movies. They ordered meals from restaurants to be delivered to the apartment. Blaise always had a tough time getting them out, even here. But Abby took exquisite care of her. She monitored her blood counts and checked her pump scrupulously, and did everything for Salima. And Salima looked immaculate, beautifully groomed, and perfectly put together. The only thing Abby couldn't do was braids and sing, and Salima teased her mercilessly about both. Abby went out to the kitchen a few minutes later, set the table, and served them freshly made waffles.
"I forgive you for not being able to sing," Salima announced with a mouthful of waffles and diabetic maple syrup.
"Your waffles are fantastic." Abby loved to spoil her in countless small ways. It made Blaze's heart ache. Abby was the mother that she knew she could never be. She didn't have the time or the patience. Abby did. Blaise lived in a much bigger world, which she had shielded Salima from religiously. Salima was not a secret, but Blaise never talked about her diabetes or her blindness, and she had kept her away from the press all her life. Blaise was intensely private and protective of Salima. Her going blind, and being diagnosed with diabetes before that, had broken Blaise's heart and Harry's. He had never been able to adjust to it. And rather than accepting that he had a blind daughter and dealing with it, he ran away from it and hardly ever saw her. It was too painful for him. He sent her birthday cards and had Blaise buy her Christmas and birthday gifts. He didn't know what she wanted even as a young child, and her blindness confused him. So he didn't bother getting her anything and asked Blaise to do it, which she did, and always credited him with fabulous gifts, beautiful dolls when she was younger, which she enjoyed even if she couldn't see them. She was like any other child. She loved music as she got older,
leather jackets, a fur parka when she turned 18 that Salima had worn ever since. But her father, hardly ever coming to see her, had been a disappointment to her all her life. He never called her either. She rarely spoke about it, and had made her peace with it, but sometimes when his name came up, Blaise could see how much it had hurt her. Blaise tried to explain it to Harry, to no avail. He just said he couldn't. He found parenting any child hard enough, but doing so for a blind one was too much for him. It was easier for him to ignore her. "What do you want to do after lunch?" Blaise asked her, as Abby put the dishes in the dishwasher Blaise had bought them. "How about a movie? I just got two new ones." She particularly loved musicals. She had watched Annie and Mamma Mia and Mary Poppins and The Sound of Music hundreds of times and sung along. "Why don't we get some air?" Blaise suggested. "You can watch a movie any time. It's a beautiful day outside." It was the one problem Blaise always had with her. It was hard to get her out of her comfort zone, even to go for a walk on the grounds. She didn't like to go out unless she had to, and Abby didn't push her. She hated making Salima unhappy, and Salima liked to stay home in the cozy cottage. The only time she left it now was to go to school. "Tell me about your trip," Salima said, trying to distract her from her insisting on a walk, but genuinely interested too. Blaise told her about both interviews, and how fascinating both subjects had been. She told her all about Dubai, or what she'd seen of it, and the diamond bangle from Cartier. She had Salima feel it on her wrist. "It feels expensive," Salima said with a grin. "He must have liked you a lot." "No, he was just generous. Saudis are. And how would you know it's expensive?" Blaise was intrigued. "It's heavy, and I can feel the diamonds all around it. It wasn't cheap." "No, it wasn't," Blaise agreed with a smile. "Was he handsome?" She loved hearing about her mother's trips and listening to her interviews. She was Blaise's biggest fan, and her mother was hers. Salima was a remarkable girl, and had been since she was a child. She was sad that Harry hardly knew her, and that she herself didn't have more time to spend with her. The years had flown by. "He was very handsome and extremely smart," Blaise said about the Saudi prince. "Was he hot for you, Mom?" Salima teased her, mostly because of the bracelet. But she knew her mother was beautiful. Everyone said so. "No, I'm about 10 or 12 years older than he is, so that rules me out. And he already has 3 wives. That's 3 too many for me." Salima knew all about her mother's romance with Andrew, and how it had turned out and why. She had met him and liked him, and he had made an effort with her. But she didn't like how it had ended, or how dishonest he had been with her mother. Salima had been 14 at the time, and her mother's voice had sounded so sad afterward, for months, maybe a year. It made Salima's heart ache to hear her. Salima herself had had a couple of romances at the school, but all the boys there were too young for her now, and she hadn't met anyone at college. She was always with Abby, and they came and went for her classes and never stuck around. And Salima was shy. With sighted people, she was self-conscious about being blind, and the only sighted people she knew were teachers, not kids. It was the downside of living at a school for the blind. She had no idea how to behave around people who could see. All her peers were blind, and had been for the past 11 years, since she was 8 years old. But Blaise was still convinced that she was better off here. But as the years went by, Salima was less and less familiar with the outside world. New York would have been a jungle for her now, and far more dangerous than Blaise was willing to deal with. At Caldwell, Blaise knew she was safe, and Salima never asked to come home. She only did so when she had no other choice, when school was closed for vacations. It took some doing, but Blaise finally convinced her to go for a walk. She described the trees to her, turning orange and scarlet, and Salima tucked her hand into her mother's arm as they walked, while Abby walked right behind them and said nothing.
She was there if they needed her, but she didn't want to intrude. She was always very discreet, and Blaze liked her nearby. She was never alone with her daughter, and preferred it that way. She didn't feel competent to meet Salima's needs if something unexpected happened, and she knew Abby could. All Blaze could do, as far as she was concerned, was tell her stories of her work and travels and make her laugh. They always had fun together, which was something. But Salima needed so much more than that. Abby made them hot tea when they got back to the cottage, and Blaze sat with them until late afternoon when it started to get dark. And at 6 o'clock, with a tone of regret, she said she should leave. She had a long drive back to the city. "Would you like a sandwich before you go?" Abby offered with her gentle smile. "No, I'm fine. I should get on the road." She hated to leave. She always did. "I'll come back soon," she said, as she hugged Salima, who clung to her mother for a minute, savoring the feel and smell of her. She always loved the scent of her perfume and her shampoo. Sometimes she could smell her in a room. Salima's senses, other than her sight, were acute, especially hearing and smell. "I'll call you this week," Blaze promised, vowing to herself that she would. She loved being with her, and hated how life got away from them and interfered. Salima was the greatest gift of her life, no matter how infrequently she saw her. "Thanks for coming up, Mom," Salima said with a smile, as she walked her mother to the door. "It was fun. It always is when you're here." She thought her mother was exciting. "I can't wait till you come home for Thanksgiving," Blaze said, and meant it. "I'll get tickets to a Broadway musical. That would be fun." And she knew Salima would love it. They tried to see a musical whenever Salima came to town. "The opera would be nice, too, or a concert. Beethoven, if there is one." She looked excited at the prospect. The one way to spark her interest and get her out was always music. "I'll see what's playing that weekend," Blaze promised. "Drive safely," Salima admonished her as Blaze hugged her for a last time. "I will." Salima waved and then closed the door, and as Blaze left, she could hear Salima put music on, and the two girls laughing again. They had a good time together, and as she walked to her car, Blaze felt strangely left out, and she realized how lucky Abby was. She had so much time with Salima, and Salima loved her so much. At times, Blaze wished that she had made different choices, but she knew that the choices she had made were right for both of them. Blaze needed her work as part of who she was, and Salima was happy at the school. It was just the way things were. And as she got on the road and headed south, she wiped a stray tear from her cheek. Chapter 4. The week after Blaze's visit to Salima was typical of life at the network. She planned her show, covered a variety of stories, did several editorials, and was working on 2 specials when she heard a rumor and at first wondered if it was true. It was the kind of thing one heard frequently, that someone was being hired or fired or shifted around, that management was making changes, and often it was only gossip. She had learned over the years not to panic or react too quickly. The network was a rumor mill. The first she heard of it was from Charlie, who told her simply that there was a new girl in town. She'd been brought in from an affiliate in Miami. She'd been a model before that, and he had said she was a knockout and 29 years old. And the next day, Blaze heard it from Mark. The new girl was going to be doing weekend news for a while, which was where new faces often started, to try them out. And when Blaze was introduced to her at a meeting, she was as beautiful as Charlie had said. She was a tall, statuesque blonde, with astounding breast implants and a tiny waist, and she had a lovely face. And Blaze thought she seemed enthusiastic and smart. Susie Quentin had gone to Brown and had a master's in journalism from Columbia. As they left the meeting, the new girl in town walked over with an awestruck look as she spoke to Blaze. "I've always wanted to meet you," she said in a breathy tone that Blaze couldn't envision on the news.
Her voice was unfortunate and made her sound less bright than she was. But her looks more than compensated for it. And her eyes observed everything. And Blaze had the distinct impression that Susie Quentin was gunning for her. Blaze could smell it, and she'd been there for too long not to know how it worked. It was how she had come in, 25 years earlier. She had arrived from San Francisco to replace someone else, whom the world had forgotten long since, and Blaze had too. She couldn't even remember her name, and she'd only been there for a few years before Blaze. But with Blaze, they had gotten a lot more than they'd ever expected. She had become a major star at the network. There wasn't a house in the entire country where they didn't know her name. And everyone working at a network, an affiliate, in any city, wanted to be her. And Susie Quentin had come from Miami to do just that. She wanted to be the new Blaze McCarthy. And as their eyes met, Blaze knew she was in trouble again. It had happened before. They had brought in others over the years to warm them up and get them ready to take her place. It had always backfired. But she knew that one day someone would come along, smarter or better, more exciting and prettier to look at, and young above all, and she'd be gone. She just wasn't ready for it to happen yet. Blaze was at the top of her game. Her specials were getting better and better, her editorials more astute, and her ratings were solid. And now they had brought this girl in. And just looking at her, Blaze could feel management breathing down her neck. "You were my idol and role model all through school," Susie said to Blaze, as Blaze felt her blood run cold. Susie Q, as people were calling her behind her back, made Blaze feel about 90 years old. "That's nice to hear. Welcome to New York," Blaze said, trying not to look upset. She was a big network star, after all, and tried to tell herself that she had nothing to fear. But Blaze knew better. There was always something to fear at the network. "I just got here last week," Susie explained. "Everyone's been terrific. They're letting me use a corporate apartment till I find a place." More bad news. They never let anyone use those apartments unless they expected them to go far, or were planning to see that they did. They were obviously investing in Susie Quentin and expected to get their money's worth. When she went back to her office, Blaze's heart was in her feet and her stomach between her ears. Mark said nothing to her about it until the next day. He knew he had to tell her before she heard it from someone else. "They're giving Susie Q a special on the homeless to do," he said in an undertone. It was an important story and a major piece, and the kind of thing they would have normally asked Blaze to do. "Thanks for the tip," Blaze said without further comment, and went back to work at her desk. She knew what this meant for her. She would have to work even harder and better and longer hours, be more innovative and creative, and keep her ratings up in the stratosphere somewhere. They were already great, but there was no room now for any slips. The pressure was on. Blaze was panicked, even if she didn't show it, and she started going to the gym in the afternoon after work to stay calm. She called her trainer and a masseuse and made a date with both for the weekend, and she worked late every night developing new ideas. She wondered briefly if they'd only brought Susie in to push Blaze harder and make her produce. But looking at Susie, Blaze knew that wasn't true. They were grooming her for something big. And it didn't get bigger than Blaze. It might take her a year to get there, but she was on her way, like a heat-seeking missile headed for Blaze's seat. Blaze hadn't been this stressed in years, and for the next 2 weeks, she concentrated on her work to the exclusion of all else. There was no margin for error now. In spite of the pressure and distractions at work, she called Salima several times just to check in. She didn't tell her what was going on at the network. But Andrew Wayland called her from L.A. a week after Susie had arrived. He had heard the rumors, too. In true passive-aggressive style, he told Blaze he was worried about her and the strain it would put on her. But in truth, he had just called to gloat. He was still angry that she had ended their affair when she found out his divorce was a lie, His career in L.A. wasn't going well, and his ratings had slipped severely.
"You don't need to worry about a thing," he reassured her, sounding loving but fake to Blaze. She knew him well. "She could never handle your job. There will never be another you."
But she wasn't so sure. One day there would be, and maybe that time was now. His sympathy sounded insincere.
"You never know," she said calmly, sounding noncommittal. "So how's life in L.A.? Do you get to the beach every day?"
He had moved to Malibu, in a spectacular house she had seen in a magazine, while he and his wife posed by the pool. The wife he had supposedly still been planning to divorce, even after Blaze left him. Another lie, until it became obvious it wasn't true. They looked like the perfect couple, in matching white shirts and jeans, with his arm around her, and California smiles, in the magazine spread she'd seen. Even after leaving him, seeing the article had upset her, and hearing from him only made it worse. But she always took his calls, and was never sure why. Probably because there was no one else to talk to about her life. They knew each other so well, and familiarity counted for something. It was a poor excuse, but the only one that made sense to her. But he always managed to hurt her feelings, even when he appeared to be nice. Sometimes it was even worse when he was. It made her miss him, and the good times they'd had before she'd learned the truth. He had been so convincing. And now she no longer believed a word he said.
"We ought to have dinner sometime for old time's sake. I'm coming to New York in a few weeks," he said in a smooth voice, like the snake in the Garden of Eden.
"Yeah, maybe," she said vaguely, although she knew she wouldn't. She had no desire to torture herself to that extent. All she did now was take his calls and listen to him, but never see him. She hadn't seen him in over a year, and didn't want to again. Her ultimate goal was to stop talking to him entirely, by phone, text, or email, but she hadn't achieved it yet.
"I'd better get back to work. Thanks for the call."
Why was she thanking him? She asked herself as she hung up. For what? Upsetting her again? Scaring her about Susie? Making her doubt herself? Reminding her of what a liar he'd been and how badly she'd been hurt? She had felt like roadkill for a year after they broke up, and now she was numb. She couldn't listen to any man now without wondering if he was lying to her. Andrew's legacy lived on, and maybe always would. Blaze could no longer imagine believing a man again, and didn't want to. There was no room for romance in her life anymore. And with Susie Q in her face, romance was the last thing on her mind. All she wanted was to save her skin. And the rumors about Susie were rampant. She was management's new golden child, and they thought she could do no wrong, although she had yet to prove herself. And they loved her youth and her look. 2 weeks after Susie arrived at the network, Blaze was working on a story when the phone rang and Mark was out to lunch. She picked it up herself. All she could hear at the other end was incoherent sobbing, and she had no idea who it was or if the call was even for her.
"Hello? Who is this?"
Blaze asked the unknown caller from a blocked number, sounding confused.
"I'm sorry, are you there?"
And then she heard a familiar scream. It was a sound she hadn't heard in years. Salima. She had screamed that way as a baby, and when she started to go blind and was scared, Blaze's heart started to race.
"Salima? Talk to me, is that you?"
And then the voice broke down in sobs. She was talking incoherently and saying something about Abby, but Blaze still couldn't understand what it was.
"Baby, come on, slow down. What happened?"
With a feeling of panic, she wondered if Abby had quit or been fired. It was the only reason Blaze could think of for Salima to fall apart. And if she'd been fired, Blaze would force Caldwell to bring her back. There was nothing they couldn't fix.
"Where are you?"
Blaze asked her, wondering if Abby was there. Had they had an argument? Was Abby hurt?
"At the cottage,"
she said in a tone of anguish.
It was the first thing she had said that Blaze could understand. "Where's Abby?" In answer to the question, Salima broke down in sobs again. It was several very long minutes before she could speak again, while her mother told her to breathe. "She got sick. She woke up this morning with a fever. I called Mrs. Garner and asked her to send the nurse. She called the doctor and they took her away. They took her to the hospital, and they wouldn't let me go with her." "Baby, she'll be all right," Blaze said in a soothing tone. But Salim only cried harder. "It's probably just a really bad flu, and they don't want you to catch it. They said she had meningitis. I called the hospital and they wouldn't let me talk to her. They said she was sleeping. I never got to say goodbye to her, Mom." Her voice was raw, and a chill ran down Blaze's spine. "Why would you say goodbye to her?" her mother asked her, sounding frightened. "She's dead," Salima said, and then dissolved in sobs again, as Blaze sat clutching the phone in disbelief. She had died within hours, which Blaze was aware happened with meningitis, but it was impossible to believe. She looked at her watch and knew what she had to do. "I'll be there as fast as I can. I'll leave the office in a few minutes. Hang in, baby. I'm on my way. I know this is awful, beyond awful. It's unthinkable. I'll be there in 3 hours." It took a few minutes, but she got Salim off the phone and called Charlie. She told him she had a family emergency and had to leave immediately. And with a lump in her throat, she told him she couldn't do her broadcast the next day. "I know this is short notice, and I'm sorry, but I have no choice." "What happened? Is your daughter okay?" He sounded concerned. Blaze never left the office without plenty of warning, nor missed her broadcasts, ever. "The woman who takes care of her just died. She's hysterical. She loves her more than she loves me." She said it without rancor, and he was one of the few people at the network, other than Mark, who knew Salima was blind and diabetic. "Just go," he said kindly. "Call me tonight, and let me know when you're coming back." "It might be a few days," she said honestly. "This is going to be really hard for my kid. And Charlie," she said as an afterthought, "please don't give Susie Q my morning spot to fill in." Blaze knew better than anyone that this was no time for her to disappear, and she had never done that before. It might give Susie her big break. But she couldn't face that now, too. Not yet. "Don't worry. It won't happen." Charlie loved working with Blaze. They were a great team. "Just relax and go take care of your kid." "Thank you," she said and hung up, and then dialed the school. She asked for the headmaster to make sure that they had someone with Salima who'd be able to comfort her until Blaze arrived. He explained to Blaze what had happened. "We still can't believe it. She was dead in 4 hours. She was fine yesterday. They said meningitis is like that. Now we're worried about an epidemic." He sounded panicked, and so was Blaze, for Salima. "What are you going to do?" Blaze asked in a strained voice. She was worried about Salima now, living so closely with her. What if she had been exposed and died too? Blaze felt sick thinking about it. Salima was the only person in the world she loved, and she knew enough about bacterial meningitis, which Abby had died of, to know that you could get it from an infected person coughing or sneezing. "I don't know yet. We'll talk about it when you get here. I'm meeting with someone from the Board of Health in an hour." He had just come from telling Abby's mother that her daughter had died. It had been a nightmarish day for the entire school, but for Salima, most of all, they both knew. "I'll be there as fast as I can." She told him what she had said to Salima, and then she flew out the door. She passed Mark in the hall and told him where she was going and why. "Oh my God," was all he could think of to say, looking shocked. "Is there anything I can do?" She shook her head and raced past him. She was in the elevator within seconds and across the lobby. She found Tully outside and had him drive her home, where she threw some clothes into a bag. And then he took her to her garage and helped her get her bag in the car. "You need to calm down before you start driving," he told her sternly. "You'll kill yourself getting there if you don't." "I'll be fine," she said, but didn't look it. And 3 minutes later, she was on the road, weaving through traffic toward the East River to drive north. She drove as fast as she could all the way. She fully expected to be stopped by the police, but she wasn't. And she was at Caldwell 2.5 hours later. She went straight to the cottage, where Salima was crying uncontrollably, and Blaze took her in her arms and held her while she sobbed. All she could do was hug her and make soothing sounds. There was nothing to say, no way to make it better, and worst of all, no way to bring Abby back. Salima sounded as though her heart were broken, and eventually Blaze put her to bed. One of the school monitors Blaze knew only slightly was with her, and Blaze sat on her bed and held her hand until Salima fell asleep. And as soon as she did, Blaze went to find Eric, the headmaster, in the main building where he lived. He looked devastated when he greeted Blaze, and she could see that he had been crying too. "We're closing the school. Tomorrow," he said with an ominous look, as Blaze stared at him in shock yet again. "Forever?" He shook his head in answer. He was running out of words. "The Board of Health recommends that we close for 60 to 90 days, depending on whether or not we get any new cases. We have to send everyone home. It's dangerous for any of us to be here. We were all exposed to Abby. We notified everyone an hour ago. Several of the parents have already picked their children up. I'm expecting a dozen more tonight. The rest are leaving in the morning. Above all, we want to avoid an epidemic." "What will happen to the kids?" Blaze asked in a shaking voice. "We are going to send as many monitors home with them as we can. But I have a problem, Blaze," he said, eyeing her squarely. He had always been honest with her, for the past 11 years, and she considered him a friend. "None of the monitors who'd be suitable for Salima can leave here. None of the female ones, that is. They're all married and have kids and live nearby, and they won't go to New York. I've talked to them all." "What about Lara, the girl who's with her now? She has a husband and 2 kids. She won't go. She had a hell of a time even finding someone for them for tonight. She doesn't usually live in." Which was why Blaze had hardly ever seen her and didn't recognize her at first. And she didn't work weekends. "I have someone terrific for you, but not a woman. He's a great guy." Blaze looked horrified by what he said. "I can't take a guy with me. I travel all the time. He can't get Salima dressed or in and out of the bathtub. What am I supposed to do with that?" "Make it work. It's all I can do," he said honestly. "He's the best teacher I've got. I would have sent him home with Timmy Jenkins, but they're putting Timmy in another school now in Chicago, closer to home. They've been wanting to for a while. So that frees up Simon. I asked him, and he's willing to go to New York." "I can't take a man," Blaze said stubbornly. "You have to get me someone else. A man won't work." She was desperate. He had to help her. "He's all I've got." Eric looked at her unhappily, and Blaze looked panicked. "It's him or no one. Don't you have a woman who can help you out? A housekeeper of some kind?" "I have a housekeeper, but she only works days. She doesn't live in. And I travel for work at least half the time. This will be very hard on her." "It's hard on us having to close the school. We all have to make the best of it. When are you taking Salima out? You can leave tonight if you like."
"She's asleep. We'll leave in the morning."
"When is Abby's funeral?" Blaze asked. She had never met Abby's mother, and knew it must have been devastating for her to lose her daughter.
"It's the day after tomorrow," he said grimly. It had been the worst day in the history of the school.
"I'd like to stay till then, for Salima's sake," Blaze said quietly. "She'll want to go. I guess we can stay at the bed and breakfast till then."
"I'll tell Simon to be ready in the morning," Eric said, looking harried. He had 50 students to send home, with monitors to go with them, and a school to close.
"Can I at least meet him?" Blaze asked, sounding skeptical.
"Of course. I'll have him in my office at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. I think he'd be great for Salima. In a way, better than Abby, although I loved her too. But Simon has excellent training, and his skills are very strong. He went to Harvard. He has a master's in special ed and another one in psychology.
He's been here as long as Abby, and I'd trust him with my life.
He's a guy, Blaze said, looking unhappy.
She left Eric then, and went back to the cottage. Salima was still asleep, and Lara had gone to sleep on the couch in a sleeping bag. She didn't want to use Abby's bedroom, and was nervous about even being there. Blaze was planning to sleep with her daughter. Blaze called Charlie on her cell phone while standing in the kitchen, and lowered her voice so she didn't wake anyone up. The last thing she wanted was Salima awake and crying all night.
"How's it going?" he asked her.
"It's a mess. The only monitor they can give me for her is a man. I don't know how we're going to work that."
"You'll figure out something. Maybe you can find someone here."
"Yeah, maybe. But I'd rather have someone from the school. I just don't know what to do with a guy. I'm not set up for that."
She was convinced it wouldn't work.
"Do you know when you're coming back yet?"
Charlie sounded worried.
"The funeral is the day after tomorrow. We'll stay at the bed and breakfast till then. Salima will want to go. I'll need to be off tomorrow and the day after, and then I'll come back to work."
"That's fine. Don't worry about it. You're entitled to 3 days off."
Not with Susie Quentin on deck, Blaze thought to herself, and competing with her, with the management guys snowed by her. The timing was terrible on this. And now Salima would be at home for 2 or 3 months, and Blaze would be pulled in all directions with a male caretaker for her, who would be more of a headache than a help.
"Stay in touch," Charlie told her, "and let me know if I can do anything to help."
"Thanks, Charlie,"
Blaze said, and hung up.
She put on her nightgown after that, and slipped into bed with Salima, who was sound asleep.
Salima started crying again the next morning as soon as she woke up. Blaze made her breakfast, which she wouldn't eat, and then went to shower and dress. And she was at Eric's office at 9 o'clock to meet Simon, and left Salima at the cottage with Lara. She hadn't told Salima yet that Simon was coming to New York. And as soon as Blaze saw him, her heart sank. Simon Ward looked proper and respectable and was wearing a blazer and jeans. His hair was trimmed, and he was wearing a clean, well-ironed shirt. But he was tall and well-built and good-looking, and was about 35 years old, with dark hair and eyes. Everything about him said male. And all she needed was for him to fall for Salima, who was a beautiful girl. This was a headache she just didn't need, especially now. Eric invited them all to sit down in his office, and Simon looked a lot more relaxed than Blaze. He was deeply sympathetic to her loss, and said he knew how attached Salima had been to Abby, and he was prepared to do everything he could to help both mother and daughter at this trying time.
"I don't think this will work," Blaze said honestly to Simon. "We're just not set up to have a man in the house. And who will dress her? I leave for work at 6 a.m. and I travel most of the time."
"If I lay out her clothes for her, she can dress herself," he said calmly. He didn't add that at 19 she should have been doing that herself for years. But he knew Abby had babied her and did everything for her. He and Abby had argued about it at staff meetings when they discussed their caseloads and theories about them. He had said that she wasn't doing Salima any favors by treating her like a child. "I think we'll do fine," he said in a gentle voice. But Blaze wasn't convinced. She could think of 1,000 things that could go wrong. She looked deeply worried. "We'll do the best we can. Is there anything you'd like to ask me?" he asked Blaze, looking her in the eye.
"How long have you been doing this kind of work?" she asked.
But it didn't make a difference. She didn't want a man. "For 8 years, since I left graduate school. I'm 32. I graduated from Harvard. My master's degrees are in special ed and psych. And my brother went blind at 18. He was a downhill racer training for the Olympics. He got a head injury and lost his sight. He gave up on everything at first. He's 2 years older than I am, and I just wouldn't let him give up."